Good morning, Miss Gray. Please sit down. I'm Captain Luckner. This is Sergeant Nikolai.
Hello.
How do you do?
Sorry. No more coffee. Miss Gray, do you know this gentleman?
No.
Did you ever see him before?
Yes, a few times.
Where?
At the patio apartments. We both live there.
Do you know who he is?
Yes. When I moved in a few days ago, Mr. Steele was pointed out to me by the manager. She was very proud of having a celebrity for a tenant.
Did you see Mr. Steele last night?
Yes. As I came home, I saw him going to his apartment with a girl.
That girl was Mildred Atkinson. She was murdered between 1 and 2 o'clock this morning.
Murdered?
Yes. Strangled by the vice-like grip of an arm.
You know, mugged.
What time did you get home last night?
Shortly after midnight.
Did you see Mr. Steele after he and the girl entered his apartment?
Yes, about a half an hour later. I saw him at his door saying goodnight to her.
How do you know it was a half hour later?
Usually it takes me that long to get ready for bed.
Can you see Mr. Steele's door from your bedroom?
She was standing on her balcony in a negligee.
It was a warm night. My apartment was stuffy.
You're sure he didn't leave with the girl?
Positive.
What was he doing?
I believe he was looking at me.
Considering that you've never met Mr. Steele, you've paid quite a bit of attention to him.
Mm-hmm. I have at that.
Do you usually give such attention to your neighbors?
No.
Were you interested in Mr. Steele because he's a celebrity?
No, not at all. I noticed him because he looked interesting. I like his face.
I guess that'll be all for now. Goodbye, Miss Gray.
Goodbye, Captain Lockner.
Hello and welcome to Book vs. Movie. This is a podcast where we read books that have been adapted into movies, and then we try to decide which we like better, the book or the movie. I am Margot P. of ColoniaBook.com, and this is my good friend and co-host, Margot D. of Brooklyn Fitchick.
Hi, everyone.
It is Friday. It's been a long week. And we've been so, I mean, I know, because we've been talking offline, we've been so excited to talk about this book and movie. This was a listener suggestion, and we have been doing, since we've gone into this pandemic time, we've been doing a brand new episode every single week. And that means, one, that we're looking for kind of shorter literary sources, so not just books, but novellas, short stories, maybe a magazine article. And the other thing is that we need a lot of suggestions, because
yes,
we're running out of ideas. So we were very grateful to have this week's suggestion from one of our listeners. But if you have suggestions for future episodes of Book versus Movie, or if you want to interact with me, Margot P., or Margot D., or other listeners of this podcast, there are several places where you can do that on the internet.
Yes, we have a private Facebook page. That's the best place to interact with us and other listeners. It's, you just go to facebook.com, type in Book vs. Movie Podcast, and ask to join. We're always, like Margot says, looking for suggestions. And I like how they advise one another. You know, we need to be able to get the book. If the book is out of print, we can't use it. If the book is only a VHS, only a VHS copy, then nope, we can't use it. So we're glad that you guys kind of stay on top of that for us, which is great. And I love our suggestion today, by the way. You can also reach out to us on Twitter, Book versus Movie, spell that out. Same thing with Instagram, Book versus Movie. Send us a DM there. Give us your suggestions. And we also have, you know, your basic old timey email if you want to reach out to us. It's Book versus Movie Podcast, spell that all out, @gmail.com. That's for your comments and suggestions. And also, if you would like some stickers, you want to show your passion for the show, ask us for some stickers.
I didn't see if today's book, we are talking about a book today, if today's book was available on Audible.
It's not. We do have a promotion with Audible. Our author today, Dorothy Hughes, she does have some books that are available in Audible, just not the one that we're talking about today. Her books went out of print for a little while, and then about 10 or 15 years ago, a lot of feminists discovered her work and sort of brought her back to the fore. But there is another book that we can recommend on Audible that we'll talk about in a second.
This episode is brought to you by Kensington's newest title from Shelley Laurenston, Breaking Badger, which is available on Audible. So you could try it for free.
You go to audibletrial.com/book-versus-movie if that's how you want to try it out. You can also, this book is on in Amazon. You can get this wherever you get your books. And she writes, I've been looking at her career, she writes very sexy novels with sexy men and sexy women and sexy creatures. She has a feminist bent to what she's doing. And in Breaking Badger, it's a part of a series of stories of people who are shapeshifters. They can shift into different animals. And one of the animals they talk about here are honey badgers. And I did some research on honey badgers, and they're a very tough animal. I really liked it. You can always download on Kindle. You could download a sample chapter and check it out first. And so that's what I did for this book. And it starts with her meeting with a group of friends when they're 14 years old and they're on the bus to school, which is all kinds of triggering for me. I used to have to ride the bus to school. Just the characters that you have there and how they became friends. And then it shows them 14 years later. They're all shapeshifters. They get into all kinds of drama, family drama, romantic drama. This is part of the Frolic Network, by the way, that we've been a part of for a few months. And they're all about romance and also pop culture. So I think this is kind of like a perfect combination of it. I was super enjoying very, very much, but it's available on paperback. It's in Audible. It's available on your Kindle to check it out. So that once again, that's Shelley Laurenstein. We do have a link in our show notes for you to check it out for yourself.
You can find Breaking Badger by Shelley Laurenstein wherever books are sold, and find out more at kensingtonbooks.com.
This was one of my favorite listener suggestions. I loved the fact that they went in there and said, this book is available on Kindle and it is streaming on Amazon. It's got Humphrey Bogart and Gloria Graham. That's all I ever need, by the way. And I'm just sort of, I'm interested.
Oh, I had never heard of, I don't know how I've never heard of this movie. Okay, spoiler alert, if you're new to this show. First of all, Margo and I spoil everything. We can't even keep a secret about whether we like the book or the movie. In this case, like, I'd never heard of this movie. I'd never heard of this book. I don't know that I've even never heard of this writer. I thought I had, but I don't think it's who I thought it was. And loved both. Fantastic.
Yeah, it's our author is Dorothy B. Hughes. She was a crime writer and a literary critic. Wrote dozens of books. She's originally from Kansas City. She's raising her kids and her family. She wrote all these books. Some of the big ones are Ride the Pink Horse and In a Lonely Place. She did that for a while, and then she became a critic, and she reviewed mystery novels and crime novels, and she did this based in Arizona, but she wrote for the Los Angeles Times and a few other papers. She died in 1993, and it was one of those cases where her work, like, she was successful, but, you know, and she wrote, she's just as good as all the other film noir authors that we've talked about in the past. James R. Cain and all those other people. I think she's right up there.
It's such good writing.
It's beautiful.
It is fantastic. I mean, one of the things we always, okay, we often cover books by men because that's just how publishing world works. And that's just how Hollywood works, especially in the 1950s. And, you know, every now and again, we find a male author who is really good at writing things from a female's point of view. Mm-hmm. And I think we have a case now where we have a female author who is outstanding at writing things from the male point of view. This thing is like, I couldn't put it down.
I read it in one sitting.
I think I did too, pretty much.
I couldn't stop reading it. And it's fascinating, you know, the story in and of itself is creepy for the time, the Humphrey Bogart movie. And I watched that first, actually. I couldn't wait. I just had, because it's streaming, and I'm a big Bogart fan. And I checked it out, and I was like, well, what's this book going to be like? And let's just talk about the book first.
Because it's very different.
Ooh, is it different? So she wrote this in 1947, and we've talked about this before, but post-World War II America, very weird time, a time where men were coming home from the war and damaged and some, you know, just drank and kept to themselves and were, you know, like Mad Men, you know, the show Mad Men. They were like Don. They kind of, you know, very stoic. And some men, they missed it so much because they missed the camaraderie and they kind of had that kind of a depression to it. Some men witnessed so much trauma, it affected their lives. And this is a case where the lead is a man named Dix Steele.
Dixon Steele.
Dixon Steele.
That sounds like a porno name.
It does sound like a porno name. I mean, as you take your middle name and you put the street that you grew up on, I mean, that's probably what it is. But Dixon Steele, 1947, excuse me. And this is back when L.A. was just deserted. Like, that part of the country was
empty.
It's
true. Yes. You know, again, California, I've noticed, being a native Californian who has also lived on the East Coast, that... you know, there is sort of a delay between things that happen in the culture on the East Coast, and it takes a while for them to make their way to the West Coast. It's also true for things like economic recession. Like, we tend to experience it a year or two behind the East Coast. And so this is a similar case where we're talking about recovery after World War II. You know, we think about the 50s economic boom. This is not that. This is like, you're still in the immediately after the war slump of Los Angeles. You know, I hadn't really been aware of how much, I mean, we've covered, as you said, a few things now of the processing, you know, the cultural processing of the trauma of the war for men and for women. I think this is a great example of that. You're looking at, and I love the way she describes Los Angeles right after the war too. It's a very, like, I know that L.A., but I also kind of don't know that L.A. It's very interesting.
Yeah. And there's also, you know, men coming back from the war, and here they'd spent 2, 3, 4 years living in this do or die situation for some of them, you know, and then they come back to the States and it took forever to get them home. They had to be shipped home. And then by the time they got home, they were different from everybody else. And they felt really only comfortable with other servicemen. And some people took care, you know, took advantage, excuse me, of the GI Act, and they went to college. So a lot of them, the first time in their families, a lot of them, you know, were immigrants, immigrant kids, and it was the first time. And some just didn't know what to do with themselves. Some formed bike gangs and did that. And Dix is the guy who, he tells his uncle, he has a rich uncle, I guess he doesn't have very much family, that he's a writer, but he's kind of going through a slump. And so the uncle is sending him, it would be equivalent of a couple thousand bucks a month for rent.
I mean, a good amount,
yeah.
Really.
Oh, yeah. His uncle's being very generous, and he says very nasty things about him. Dix, we should say, he's a creep. He's a sexist, misogynistic creep. And really hates women.
Yes.
Really hates women.
And I love the way she writes that.
Like, oh, yeah.
It's clear from the very beginning. And it's also clear that, like, I love the way she has him. It's like he's looking for every woman that he comes across. He's looking for a reason to hate her. Right. And it might just be like the way she wears her lipstick, or it has something, nothing to do with the woman as like an actual human being. It's like the most random tiny little thing, like, oh, she got on that bus, I hate her.
You know? She thinks she's full really of herself, the way she didn't smile at me when I said something, or just he's constantly doing that. Also within this play, it's told from his point of view. He's someone that is a serial killer. He is a rapist and a killer, by the way. And
yeah, that's a big difference between the book and the movie.
Yeah,
he is a full on rapist.
Yeah.
What's similar, we should say, is one, that he's a writer, two, that he's in, you know, he's in Los Angeles, Hollywood. I think he lives in Beverly Hills. Right? Isn't he in Beverly Hills? But again, this is Beverly Hills. This is not Beverly Hills like y'all are thinking. It was the suburbs. It was not that ritzy, then yet. And also, excuse me, he looks up his old army buddy who is now a police detective. That is also true. That's the same in both versions of this story. But that's a, you know, the characters are all there, but they're all different. They all do different things, and his relationship to them is very different. But yeah, he really hates women. I forget, why does he look up his friend in the first place? Because he's been in Los Angeles for a while.
Yeah, he's been there for a little while. He knew he lived some part of town that he wasn't familiar with. What he does is he follows women for prey. Like once a month, he commits a murderous act. And we should say, for trigger warnings, they're not that gruesome. It's sort of just stated. They don't dwell on what he's doing. So you don't have to worry about that. But he picks somebody and he'll follow her for a while. And then sometimes he gets foiled, like a woman's boyfriend will show up or her pet will show up or something or whatever. And so he's in some situation and that's when he remembers, oh, Brub, right?
Oh, that's right. He's like in his neighborhood.
Yeah, he's in his neighborhood.
Yeah, Brub. Brub Nikolai is his army buddy.
Yeah, that was his OC and they were friends. And Bub says, hey, you've been in California for months. You haven't come over, but my wife and I are having drinks right now. Why don't you come over?
He's like, well, with all the raping and killing, hard to squeeze it in. Some me time.
Exactly. But he shows up and Brub's wife is Sylvia. And turns out she's like a delightful woman. She's very nice and she's good to Brub. And he really respects their relationship. And he sees that they're very healthy and they love each other. And he wants to hate her, but he can't because she makes him happy and they treat each other like equals. And they have this very nice romance between this married couple. And
it's a really nice relationship.
It is.
And she's really smart. And he recognizes that she's very, very smart. So he knows she's probably the first woman that he doesn't hate right off the bat.
Right. He also realizes like she could pick up on things. You know, she pays attention to the details. So he knows to keep an eye on her. The very next, so he was going to kill somebody, he got interrupted. He goes to Brub's house and then he goes back home and he writes a letter to his uncle saying, hey, I have back problems. Can you now give me $400 a month? And at the same time, he gets a phone call from Sylvia and she says, hey, we're having lunch at the club today. Why don't you come meet us? And, you know, we're just going to, nothing fancy. We're just going to meet at the club. So he puts on the best outfit he can. And he meets them, and it turns out Brub is a detective, and he's been worried about these murders. They've been happening once a month. They don't have any clues. This is 1947. How do you solve a crime in 1947?
I know you're reading about like what they have to go on. You're like, you are never going to catch this guy.
Yeah, tire tracks.
Yeah. 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 Good luck.
Good luck with that. But he's the killer. So he's saying to Brub, like, oh, well, what do the police know? What kind of information do they have? And he's saying to them, we don't know anything. We don't know what we're doing. We're just really worried about it. And I'm super stressed about it. Don't know about you. And then we also find out that, that Dix has a crush on a redhead at his apartment. And
right. Oh, one thing we forgot to mention.
Yeah.
So Dix is living in Los Angeles and he's been there for a while and he lives in the apartment of this other man named Mel. And what he tells everybody is that Mel has gone to Rio on business. Excuse me. And he also sort of says it to himself. So you sort of for a long time, you think Mel's gone away on business to Rio.
Right.
So he's living in Mel's apartment. He's eating Mel's food. He's driving Mel's car. He's wearing Mel's clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells everybody who asks about Mel, like, oh, Mel had to go to Rio. I'm his friend. And so I'm watching the place for him while he's gone. That's how he meets Laurel, his neighbor, who's the redhead, who he instantly likes. And she's like, oh, hey, you're in Mel's place. What happened to Mel? And he's like, oh, yeah, Mel's on business. And but he doesn't hate her right away. It's the second woman he meets that he doesn't hate right away. Unlike Sylvia, like he has a full-on crush on Laurel Gray, his neighbor.
And she's pretty sharp. And they hang out together. They sleep with each other the first night. I love the fact, like the same words, they wake up and he's like, well, who gets to use the shower first? She goes, well, I don't do any cooking, so I guess it's the one who makes the coffee. And so she's self-aware, and she's she owns her space. She takes off, and then she has some dates going on. He gets jealous of her, and he's really obsessed with, you know, who's going to be his next victim? How is he going to get away with it? These two smart women.
Yeah, because he's got to keep up the pace of the killing and the
raping. He still has that in him.
Strict schedule.
Yeah, it's really hard to schedule that in and not not run into people who know you. That's a whole thing. There's a scene where, for me, it was very upsetting, where he was following a woman and she had a dog. And I don't think the dog was on the leash, but the dog came over to him and he started petting the dog, and then he realized she was alone and he killed her. And then it turns out he strangled the dog.
But it's gruesome.
Yeah.
And we should also say there's a whole thing. Like whenever Dix and Brub, what names? Whenever Dix and Brub are together, like Dix is always sort of kind of subtly trying to find out like how much the police know and how, what they've got and what they haven't got. But another thing that kind of comes up over and over again is their time during the war. And that there was a woman named Brucey who Dix had a relationship with. And Brucey, I don't know if she disappeared or she died. Like, we don't know what happened to Brucey, but it was one of those like war, you just figure like, oh, it's one of those war things, war romances. You know, he's overseas. It couldn't possibly have worked out. So it's nice that they had this fling while they had it. But it's a thing that comes up a lot, like Brucey, like one of the women that he kills, he follows her because she looks like Brucey. I don't think it's the one with the dog. But anyway, Brucey's the woman from England that he had the fling with and who keeps coming up. He keeps thinking about her.
She's one of the few women he respected, that he had good feelings for. And Sylvia is becoming suspicious of him. And his behavior and how he, you know, she's always questioning her husband about the killings and what does he do with his free time and what does he really do for a living? How does he spend his time? And he can tell that she's becoming suspicious of him. He and Laurel have like a fling, but she's starting to suspect too that there's something off about this guy.
Yeah, because she knew Mel, she knew him like kind of well, it seems. And so things are not adding up for her. Yeah. It's so cool. Like the women are the ones who are like getting wise. Like the men are like fumbling around in the dark. He thinks that, again, this is very different than in the movie. He thinks like he's going to actually have a real relationship with Laurel. And all of a sudden Laurel has vanished. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't know where she is and like what happened to her. And it's very interesting because he is somebody who has been making women vanish like this whole time.
Right.
And now he is somebody who has had the woman in his life vanish and he's experiencing what that is like. Anyway, spoiler alert.
Yeah. Yeah. Spoilers.
Laurel's fine.
Yes. And Sylvia sets him up.
Sylvia like it goes to Laurel and is like, listen, this is the killer everybody's looking for. You need to get out of Dodge, lady. And she's like, okay, sister, I'm going. And yeah, Sylvia is the one who got wise to him and frames him basically, and not frames him because he's guilty, but
she gets him to admit.
She gets him to admit that he is the killer. And the book ends with him admitting that he actually killed Brucey.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a lot of allusions to the trauma that they experienced during the war. I mean, I'm not making excuses for him.
No.
But you know, he's a very, someone who probably needed a lot of he's somebody who needed a lot of help and didn't get it. And
we also assume Mel is killed too, right? That he killed Mel to take over the apartment. Am I wrong?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that's so between the two ladies, they figure out, oh my gosh, he's killed Mel, because there's no way that Mel would leave all his clothes. And like Mel was really into his clothes. He wouldn't leave this behind. He wouldn't leave that behind. And even if he was going to Rio, he would not. This is not what he would do. So, yeah, they're the ones who put it all together. And then we assume, I guess, that he gets dragged off to jail.
Yeah.
And that's the book.
Yeah, it's a great read.
It's fantastic.
It's really interesting. It's just as good as any of the other stuff we read for film noir. I thought it was just Raymond Chandler, all that stuff. I think she's just
holds up against any of them. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's fascinating, the lead character. I mean, the way she's talking about this sociopath and how he processes information and how he, you know, oh, this woman now, she's a bitch, she's a whore, she's a all these things, you know, just like he gets so mad and so angry, he can't contain himself. And it's really great. It's, you know, it's a fun read, but it was interesting. And I super enjoyed it. Great writing.
You will really love it. If you know, it's completely different from the movie in most ways, but it's just fantastic, and it's a quick read.
Mm-hmm. It's like 200 pages, but you can go through it really quickly.
Yeah, you can. Yeah, it's excellent. Loved it. Loved it. Loved it. Loved it. But we need to talk about this movie.
Let's start with the trailer.
Did you see Mr. Steele last night?
Yes, as I came home, I saw him going to his apartment with a girl.
That girl was murdered between 1 and 2 o'clock this morning.
I hadn't anyone tell you I was a lonely one till you.
What's he doing here?
With or without his wife or tailing me?
I've been looking for someone for a long time. I didn't know her name or where she lived. I'd never seen her before. And a girl was killed, and because of that, I found what I was looking for.
First, you have to have enough imagination to visualize the crime.
You're driving up the canyon. You put your right arm around her neck. You get to a lonely place in the road, and you begin to squeeze. You're an ex-GI. You know judo. You know how to kill a person. Go ahead, bruv. Squeeze harder.
You know Dix didn't do it. You saw him after the girl left.
But Lochner has a different idea. He believes Dix could have done it. I left his office feeling as though he were trying to warn me.
I came here because I wanted to say these things out loud and be laughed at. But you're not laughing.
Let me in. So, are you taking to Las Vegas?
No, I know.
Are you packing to go on a honeymoon?
Yes, of course.
Or are you packing to run away from me like you ran away from Mr. Baker?
Dick.
This is 1950. Humphrey Bogart has been a big star for a long time now, and he's starting to produce his own films. And this is Santana Productions, I believe it was.
I think that's what his production company was called, yeah.
Yes, and he was a big fan of Nicholas Ray, and they immediately wanted to work together on this script. He wanted to have Lauren Bacall play the Laurel character, but Lauren was on with Warner Brothers and they wouldn't loan her out. And Gloria Graham, who just happened to be married to Nicholas Ray at the time, got the gig. And you remember her as Violet in This American Life, not This American Life.
It's a Wonderful Life.
It's a Wonderful Life.
She's Violet, the blonde, like, oh, this, I put this on when I don't care how I look. That's her.
She's so beautiful.
She's so good. And she's gorgeous.
Gorgeous. And she's so good in this movie. And we meet him. It's Humphrey Bogart, Gloria Graham, Frank Lovejoy. And there's a woman named Martha Stewart, but it's not that Martha Stewart. She's the actress that plays the masseuse, who's like the scariest masseuse.
Isn't she terrifying?
She's terrifying.
What? What is this? What's her story? She needs her own movie, that woman.
She definitely does.
Nicholas Ray also directed Rebel Without a Cause, mm-hmm. Johnny Guitar, which is a, have you ever seen Johnny Guitar?
Yeah, that's a bizarre movie.
It's so weird. But yeah, he was married to Gloria Graham, although they were in the process of splitting up while they made this movie. There's some scandal about that. We talked about it during It's a Wonderful Life, I think.
No, I don't know if we went into detail. I was surprised to read that she had to sign a contract in order to do this movie. And the movie studio said, between the hours of 9 and 6 p.m., he is your boss. You will do everything he asks you to do. And then they make a very specific case of saying, do not use your feminine traits such as nagging and other stuff.
Like it literally says that in print.
In print.
In her contract.
Yeah. So she had
don't use your feminine vamp powers
on him. He's the boss.
To try and get your way on set.
And they had a, you know, she had an affair. Well, she wound up marrying his stepson later.
Her stepson. His
stepson.
Is it his stepson as well?
It was his stepson.
Oh, okay. So they're not related.
No.
Okay. I wasn't clear about that. Okay. Thank you. Okay. That's. So there's some contention.
Yes, there's some tension.
She did definitely marry his stepson. Later. There's her husband in between there. He contends that she started this affair with the stepson while she was still married to him, Nicholas Ray. But there's some, who knows?
Yeah, well, Nicholas Ray also had an affair with Natalie Wood when she was, 15, 16?
Yeah, it's messy.
It's a messy time in Hollywood, and they had a messy relationship. Supposedly, they broke up in the middle of production, and he would just sleep at the studio. But he would work on the script. They changed the book, and then they had a screenplay, and then he and Humphrey Bogart worked together to change it. I mean, they were constantly like bringing it together, you know, trying new things because they didn't want to do the usual stuff that you found in movies, especially at the end, which we'll get to. But their relationship was so unusual. They wanted to kind of keep that vibe going. So what happens is that Humphrey Bogart plays a screenwriter who's down on his luck. Hasn't had a hit since the war. It's also there's a lot about Hollywood. And that Hollywood, you know, is only interested in those that make money. It's only interested in the beautiful people.
And, yeah.
You know,
it's very interesting because we are still in that post-war slump.
Mm-hmm.
Hollywood is the industry of Los Angeles. And so that the industry is in a slump. I love there's so many really great touches in this movie. It's so good. I don't even know where to begin. First of all, there's the apartment complex. So he's not living in somebody else's apartment. In the movie, he's a successful, famous screenwriter. Like people know who he is everywhere he goes. He's not like saying that he's a writer and getting checks from his uncle. He's a successful guy who's made a lot of money for Hollywood. And we're told that, you know, before the war, he was very famous. And now he's like everybody else. He's trying to get things going after the war. I love the older actor that's his actor friend
mm-hmm.
in the bar, who is a friend of Humphrey Bogart's from his theater days, like when he was super young in the 1920s. And so they wrote this part for him. That apartment is modeled off of the apartment that Nicholas Ray lived in.
Mm-hmm.
There, I love those kind of apartment complexes in Los Angeles. They're all over the place. We have them here in San Diego too. These weird, like courtyardy, everybody lives around a courtyard in a little place. Anyway, the art direction is just fantastic. Oh, and the lighting is great. And the dialogue is amazing. And the other thing is they like, there's a lot of talk about like, you know, he hasn't had a hit since the war, basically. Right. So it's this all about like, he needs to have a hit, which is not a MacGuffin, but basically the inciting incident of the movie is that he's the screenwriter. Dix is a screenwriter, famous screenwriter, and he's supposed to be working on an adaptation of a book, this book that he does not want to read and is not interested in. And he goes to this club and the hat check girl has read the book as he checked in with his coat. And I guess she's a super fast reader because she's like blazed through this giant book. So he pays the hat check girl to come to his apartment and tell him the gist of the story, which she does.
Yep. Very animatedly.
Very animated. She's so cute.
She's adorable.
As she tells the whole story and then she leaves.
Right. He sends her on her way.
And then she's found dead.
Yeah, she's found dead by the strangler. And the police call him in and said, look, the last person to see you, you were the last person to be with Mildred. And now Mildred is dead. So what did you say happened? He goes, I don't know what happened to her. We were hanging out. And
it sounds kooky. Like, yes. She came to my house to tell me a story and I paid her.
And I paid her and then I sent her on her way. And the other like, yeah,
Hollywood.
Sure. Yeah, in Hollywood.
Yeah, sure.
And then that's when the police call in Laurel, who's played by Gloria Graham. And she is a neighbor. And she says, oh, I saw him like around midnight. And he was alone. I saw her leave and I didn't see him leave again. So she's providing an alibi. And they say, you know.
Right. Which we know is true. We see we see them see each other. So we know, which I really like. So we know she's not just like lying to. She's telling the truth.
No, she says, you know, I was there. She also said, I liked his face. That's what I noticed. I liked his face. They begin a relationship. They live in the same apartment complex. They both just been to a police station. There's some conversation you can have, you know, about that. He does have the friends Brub and Sylvia, and Brub is with the police department. And he has this weird thing where he's always asking him, what happened with the killers? How's that going? How do they do it?
Yeah, which is weird.
Yes.
Which, I mean, in the book, it's because, you know, he's trying to find out what the police know. In this case, he's sort of like, first of all, like everybody agrees, everybody who knows him agrees that he's kind of weird. Like, mm-hmm. Dix is a little strange and, you know, he's not like other people. And he, you know, he has this weird, like morbid writer's curiosity that needs to know all the gruesome details. And, but Sylvia, Brub's wife, is like, why does he keep asking about these murderers? Like, what is his deal? Why does he care? And yet he does, you know, he keeps asking. But meanwhile, like he's getting close to Brub and Sylvia in a post-war environment. And he's also having this relationship with Laurel, who also has like a bit of a murky past.
Mm-hmm.
She's a lady with a past and secrets of her own. So everybody's got stuff that they're hiding from everybody else, which is so cool to see. Meanwhile, they're all on screen together like, oh, we're just having this fun picnic. Isn't this great? meanwhile, like all kinds of subtext going on, like with every single person that you see on screen. It's fantastic.
Yeah. They have this picnic and it's by the ocean ish, you know, it's the and he has a flip out and he has a hair trigger temper. This is where we find out, like, he just kind of loses his temper out of nowhere. And he gets in the car with her. And we've seen these scenes before where you're just going around the canyon and you're hitting all the turns. And
which there are loads of roads like that in Southern California because of the canyons. Like, I have like three of them right outside of where I live.
Yeah.
And you driving around these blind curves. And yeah, we have a lot of movies like that where people are like around the curves and you can't see what's coming up and there's a car there. I liked that because that's one of the things, as we said about the book, is that Dix has this weird temper. Like, the most like banal things completely set him off. Now in the book, they are his reason to kill people. Here he just, you know, and again, it's this unprocessed trauma of the war. And so it's, you know, in the movie, I really like that it is very much about that. Like, there's so many references to the war and he hasn't been the same since the war and he hasn't had a hit since the war. And while we don't like to talk about the things that happened during the war. And so, yeah, there, you know, he just flies off the handle for the tiniest thing. And now they're in the car and they're and what I love about that scene where they're racing in the car down the, you know, the around mm-hmm. the windy curves is Gloria Graham is like so cool. She's not like, stop. She's like, oh crap, I really have to keep it together because this guy is like already super on edge and I got to do what I can do to like chill this situation out.
Why, you blind, knuckleheaded squirrel. Don't you look where you're going?
Take it easy.
Take it easy. Look at my car. I just got a new paint job. $200. I'd have dragged you out of this land and barged in.
Dick! Stop it! Stop it! Let him alone! It's dangerous!
But then he hits a guy.
Yeah, then he crashes into a person, and then that guy wants to punch him. And he's like, oh, great, I've been waiting for this. He's like been dying to punch somebody. But she stops him from like actually killing the guy because he was going to take
a rock. He's going to kill this guy with a giant rock.
For nothing. For nothing.
For a fender bender.
Yeah, it's absurd. And they get home, and she's now kind of like, the movie switches then to her perspective because she's now wondering, all right, what is going on?
Which is amazing.
Which is
okay. So this is a phenomenal thing about this movie is that you start out and you're following Dixon Steele, Humphrey Bogart's character, and you're like learning about him, and you're sort of like, okay, yeah, he's smart. People seem to really like him. People make a lot of excuses for this guy because they like him so much. Obviously he's had some success and you're sort of rooting for him, but then like his temper is like weird and doesn't make any sense. And he like almost bashes this guy's face in with a rock and you're like, oh crap. And then there's this scene where Gloria Graham's character, Laurel, is getting a massage from terrifying Martha Stewart.
Not that Martha Stewart.
Not that Martha Stewart. Our Martha Stewart was like a little tiny girl when this movie came out.
Yeah.
This Martha Stewart is a big burly masseuse in this movie. And Martha's like, what are you doing? This is not, how is this going to end for you? Like, this is not.
He's bad news.
You must see that this is not going well, clearly. And she's like, get out of my business. Keep massaging me, but get out of my business. But then from then on out, the whole movie is from her point of view. Cause she starts thinking like, oh, well, he did almost bash that guy's face in with a rock. Well, maybe he is violent enough to be a killer.
He lost his temper for no reason at the picnic. Like, we're all at a picnic.
Reason.
And he just, like, has a flip out. And then the friends tell her, like, he tried to reenact a scene from the killing of, like, strangling the wife.
That which woman, he did.
Which he did.
Which was creepy.
And the woman is, her name is Jeff.
I know.
The actress.
It's so great.
Jeff Donald.
She's really good.
She's amazing. She played the maid of the Quartermains on General Hospital in the 80s.
That's hilarious.
And she would get a little sauced and then like be sassy to the Quartermains. Like I was a big General Hospital fan when I was a kid. But anyway, Dix asks her to marry him. And at first she says yes. And then these things start happening. And now she's like, I'm not sure if this is like the real smart decision that I should be making. He shows up at her house and he realizes she's packing her bags and that she's not wearing her ring.
Yes, because he had asked her. So after this whole picnic, almost bashed the guy's face in episode, which I think we can all agree should be a deal breaker.
Yeah.
I feel like that should be a deal breaker right there. He sort of almost violently asks her to marry him.
Yeah.
And she says yes, because she's scared. And she tells people, I said yes because I was scared and I'm trying to figure out how to get out of this thing. I'm in over my head. I don't know what to do. So after that, she's like trying to pack to get the hell out of Dodge. Like she's trying to get her plane ticket. She's trying to get out of there and save her neck. And he shows up and he's in a state. He sees that she's packing. She's like, I'm packing for our honeymoon. He's like, why aren't you wearing the ring? I got you. And it's like so scary because you don't know what he's going to do. What's interesting, I think, is that I felt at least at that point, and I had read the book and hadn't seen the movie, right? So I felt that, you know, okay, he's a mess. He's violent and unstable. And we get this whole history of violence. You know, we hear he's got a whole like police record of beating people up.
Oh, yeah.
Including a former girlfriend. So we know he beats women. But we sort of know he's not this killer that they're looking for.
He's bad, but he's not that bad.
Right. But he is dangerous. And so you are scared for her because we know he's not the killer, but we also saw him almost kill a guy, and he probably would have if you hadn't stopped him. So yeah. Who knows what this guy's going to do. And so that scene, I think, is just so scary, where he shows up and she's like pretending to pack, and he's answering her phone.
Yeah. Well, he answers the phone, and there's a police chief who calls, and the police chief says, "Hey, is Laurel there? You know, you both should hear this. We just had this person confess to that killing. So it wasn't you, and it wasn't, you know, she's not covering for you. We thought you both should know that right away. We feel bad to put stress on you. Now you guys can go on and live happy lives."
Okay, so there's that. Okay. Because, yes, thank you for bringing that up. Because to be fair, like, we're talking about, oh, he's getting angry out of nowhere. He's flying off the handle. He is also having the entire LAPD, like, tailing him and trailing him and grilling him and grilling his girlfriend and trying to pin these murders on him, which, yeah, probably stressful. Probably is probably what destroyed this relationship. And arguably, probably what got that guy beat up by the side of the road.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And they're like, sorry.
Oopsie. But you two can get married now. You don't have to worry about him, you know. And it's funny because the director, Nicholas Ray, he said he wanted them to break up, but he didn't want it to be a violent thing. He just wanted it to be more of a sad thing. And they do.
Yeah, too late.
But I'm like, exactly. He just strangled her. Like, no, there's lots of violence going on. This is 1950. But she basically is saying to him, like, he's saying to her, "Wow, you really believed I was a killer. You really don't trust me. I think I ought to go."
Jeez, man.
Yeah.
"I just saw you about to bash a guy's face in with a giant rock, and you strangled me. Forgive me for thinking you might be a killer."
Yeah. Yeah. Or the potential. So
yeah,
he walks away. And they had another ending all set up, and they just, the actors got together and came up with this idea just to have him walk away through that archway. And
which
then
is great.
Which is so good. And then she's just crying, and just beautiful crying that she's doing.
"I've been trying to get you everywhere. I've got some news that's going to take a lot of tension off you and Laurel. Just got an airtight confession from Kessler. Old friend, your hunch was right. He killed her."
"Let me speak to him. I want to apologize to him and Miss Gray."
"Is Laurel there? Captain Lochner wants to apologize to both of them."
"Man wants to apologize to you.
Sorry, I am. I had to put you through this ordeal. Mr. Steele's absolutely in the clear. I hope you'll both accept my apologies."
"Yesterday, this would have meant so much to us. Now it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all."
She's so stunning. And
it's almost distracting how pretty Gloria Graham is in this movie.
She just has so much. Should have had a bigger career. She just is so, she had a lot of problems. She had a lot of stuff come up in her life. And sadly, she passed away young from cancer. But that's it. That's the movie. And it's fantastic. I watched it three times this week. It's on Amazon. It's so good,
everything
though.
Everything about it is so considered and so well thought out and so well planned out. And that your allegiance as the audience switches from her to him. I mean, from him to her. To the point where you're like, get away from this guy. No, it doesn't matter that he's famous. It doesn't matter if he's rich. Get out of there. And there is a moment, like they have these, the relationship has these, like, what do you want to call crossroads moments where it could go really well, but it doesn't. You know, whatever happens, like sometimes it's an outside circumstance. Sometimes it's just that he's so flawed and damaged and just unable to be there, you know, in that relationship the way he needs to be. And so, you know, you sort of understand why she's sad about that, you know, that there she did care about him, but she understands it cannot work.
No, they go out to dinner at one point. He's a screenwriter and she inspires him to finish a screenplay, which he'd been working on and not really doing.
Which we're led to believe is going to be a hit.
And that, you know, she was a little wifey for him. She makes him his lunches. She makes her, he makes sure he keeps working. He makes sure he tries to get some rest in there. And so she and his agent send in his script without his permission. And he flips the F out and hits this friend. Right,
it's his friend, the one guy that's been defending
the old guy
this whole time. Who's he's not like a
spring chicken.
He's what do they call it? Punching down.
He is punching down figuratively and literally, and this person is just trying to help him. Doesn't apologize. He kind of gives gifts to people, but it becomes he's not going to apologize. Like he's just it's sort of you're going to realize like this is the deal with me.
Right. I liked that you had that moment with, he has that moment with his friend slash agent after he hits him, you know, and the agent, you could see like the agent's like, oh man, this guy, you know, who's going to be there for him if not me? So the agent is like, yeah, you know, it's okay. We're fine. Don't worry about it. But, you know, obviously like this guy is like, this is the best he can do. He really this is literally the best that Dix can do is he's going to fly off the handle for no reason out of nowhere. And he might punch you in the eye. So maybe if that's not for you, best to like break it off.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just, it's so good. The writing is so good. I love that, you know, I love what they did with that book because the book is amazing. But I love that they took these characters and took it in this different direction where like they, Laurel and Dix in the book, they don't ever really have a real relationship of any kind. Not really. You know, they sort of, they have like a few drinks together. He has a crush on her, but she's not in love with him. In the movie, she's in love with him.
Right.
And she's trying to take care of him as much as she possibly can. Feed him, put him to bed, make sure, you know, his manuscript goes to the producers, all this kind of stuff. Trying to take care of him for him, thinking that it's going to make some difference, which it doesn't do. And she realizes that, which is kind of great too. And I just, the whole thing is, and I just keep walking around with this movie in my head. It is so good.
Yeah. I've been telling everybody about it. You've got to check it out if you've never seen it before. I think I'm going to pick movie.
I am also going to pick movie. I wish there were somewhere Gloria Graham talking about this movie. I would love to know what she thought about it and how she felt about it. Nicholas Ray talks about it a lot. As we said, they were breaking up or they had already separated. And in fact, Nicholas Ray slept on the set while they were filming. telling people that other people didn't know that was going on. So he was like, yeah, I'm working, you know, I just wanted to work here and I didn't want to leave. And, but it's because they were breaking up. Interestingly, I found this very cool video all posted in the Facebook group of Nicholas Ray later, you know, in his later years after he was sort of retired from filmmaking. He taught, he was like an adjunct professor kind of in film school. And his one of his student assistants was Jim Jarmusch.
Oh, wow.
So there's this really cool video of Jim Jarmusch talking about Nicholas Ray and his impressions of Ray's work and what it was like, you know, the stuff that he learned from him as a filmmaker. And when you hear him talk about it, you're like, oh, yeah, I can totally see that. It makes perfect sense. I just think the whole thing is so, so perfectly, like Los Angeles is so perfectly rendered. That time in American history. I think there's even an allusion, if I remember correctly, that there's even an allusion to the movie The Best Years of Our Lives. Somebody mention The Best Years of Our Lives? I think he makes a crack about it.
That would have come out in like 46 or 47, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was
mm-hmm.
just when they came back from the war. So yeah.
Yeah. So it's talking about, there's these allusions to, you know, we can't just come right back from the war and like slip back into what we were all doing before the war, like nothing ever happened. We can't, that's impossible. That whole thing about Brucey is not in this Mm-mm. story at all. And I think that's a good choice as well. I just think it's so well done and watch it. I mean, I was watching, I watched so many breakdowns of this movie after this. And there was one, like this woman was saying, like, it's her favorite movie. And she's like naming all the things that she loves about the movie. And she's like, I know. So the things, what don't I like about the movie? What are the cons about this movie? She goes, Gloria Graham wears makeup to bed. That's it.
I saw that one. And I laughed.
Like, agreed.
Yeah. It's just, it's so perfect.
It's perfect.
She's
perfect.
Yeah. It comes out at a time when I was just looking to see like what were the other movies that were out then. And it was like Sunset Boulevard, Cyrano, Asphalt Jungle, Father of the Bride, Cinderella. I mean, there was just a lot of competition at the time. It wasn't nominated for anything. It just kind of it didn't make a lot of money. People didn't know how to market it. You know, bogey film that they don't, you know, they don't understand how to market him in this way. But over the years, it's become the favorites of directors. Now it's considered a classic. And
it's just brilliant.
It just was brilliant. I really enjoyed it. And I can't wait to watch it again. I probably will watch it again. It's on Amazon Prime. I could just watch it now. Yeah.
I was watching it again. I'd never seen this movie before. I had never even heard of this movie before until it was brought up in our Facebook group.
Right.
And, you know, we love Humphrey Bogart. Mm-hmm. And I was watching it. I was like, how was this movie not on television all the time when I was growing up? Like for the number of times I've seen, you know, The Big Sleep mm-hmm. or, you know, all the Bogie and Bacall movies I've seen over and over and over again. And I love Lauren Bacall, but it would not have been as good. I'm sorry.
No, Gloria Graham has this quality about her, just this haunting quality about her. Like she's got secrets, you know? Yeah. She's something special. I'm a big fan of hers.
Me too. I also posted in the Facebook group, really rather extraordinary, television episode. There was a television series that Roald Dahl did called Tales of the Unexpected, I think is what it was called.
Yeah.
And it was sort of like mini little, you know, each one was its own standalone story. And a lot of them were based on short stories of his. And this one, I can't remember what it was called, something about, anyway, it's in the Facebook group, but it stars Gloria Graham, and who was in England at the time, and Joseph Cotten, who starred in the radio adaptation of In a Lonely Place.
Oh, interesting.
Interestingly. Yeah, they did. I think it was after the movie, they did a radio adaptation. Anyway, they did this little short film television thing. It's a year before Gloria passes away. So she's already I'd imagine she's already quite ill. She is radiant. She looks absolutely freaking flawless. And it's 30 years after In a Lonely Place. This is in 1980, this thing is shot. Watch it. Just, you can just skip ahead to the Gloria Graham bits and you will, your jaw will drop. How beautiful, how talented. She's like a connect, just like in this, not in this movie, but in other movies that she did, you know, other kind of film noir. She's being her classic, like, conniving vamp. It's amazing. It is, she's just, it's like she hasn't aged a day. It's glorious.
Oh, I can't wait to watch it.
Yeah.
Well, we talked off the air about what we're covering next.
Yes.
We actually are taking a week off because I'm going to go away for the first time in 18 months. I'm going on an overnight trip. I'm going to Chicago.
Yay.
I'm very excited for that, for a wedding. But the week after that, we are going to be covering The Parent Trap.
Let's get together. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Classic lyrics.
It's classic movie, classic lyrics. Eric Costner is the author. We are so excited. We might, I might watch the Lindsay Lohan one too. Like just for shits and giggles. Why not? We have some extra time. I might get that in there.
Yeah, I haven't seen either one since my kids did not like that movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was on TV a lot when you and I were kids.
Yeah.
And so I've seen it many, many, many times. And I always used to watch it when it would come on. But no, my kids are like, what? That's a terrible idea. They shouldn't get back together. Why would you separate twins? What's wrong with you?
That's so funny. Anyway, that's going to be our next book and movie to cover. Please be sure to follow us on all the places, social media wise. Margo, where can they find you?
You can find me online at coloniabook.com, and all of my social media callouts are at She's Nacho Mama. And where can they find you?
You can find me on social media at Brooklyn Fitchick, mostly for Twitter and Instagram. My site is brooklynfitchick.com. Thank you all for tuning in and listening to us today. We will be back soon with a new episode. Thank you so much for listening to the Book vs. Movie podcast. We are a part of the Frolic Podcast Network. You can find more podcasts you will love at frolic.media/podcasts. We follow the hashtags Lady Pod Squad and Podern Family. If you want to support the show, you can go to our Patreon page, go to PATREON, and look for Book vs. Movie Podcast. We have a basic Facebook page, but we also have a private Facebook group. Go to Facebook and type in Book vs. Movie Podcast Group if you want to join that. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Book vs. Movie. Spell all those words out. If you'd like to send us an email, it's Book vs. Movie Podcast, spell that all out, at gmail.com. We do have a promotion with Audible. If you want to check out their service for free for 30 days, go to audibletrial.com/book-vs-movie. You can follow Margot D. at Brooklyn Fitchick on social media, and Margot P. at She's Nacho Mama. Thanks so much again for checking out our show, and we'll be back soon with a new episode. And with my lonely heart demanding it, Cupid took a hand in it. I had anyone till you.
Anything you want to make you happy?
What's he doing here?